Hello and welcome. This is Emphasis Added, a podcast by the Houston Law Review, where we highlight legal issues, prominent lawyers, and obscure blue book rules. We're your hosts, Adri Langemeyer and Robert Cunningham. I'm sad to share that this will be our last episode before we graduate and pass the torch to our incoming podcast editor, Kevin Donovan. We are incredibly proud of this season of Emphasis Added and grateful to have had the opportunity to talk with so many prominent lawyers in our community. Thank you to our listeners for your support. A special thanks to our sponsor, Vinson & Elkins, a global law firm with 11 offices and more than 700 lawyers, committed to excellence in serving and advising its sophisticated clients in industries such as energy, finance, technology, real estate, media, and beyond. V&E lawyers also are proud to support pro bono clients across their communities. To help clients navigate complex areas of law, V&E hires the best and brightest law students and lawyers, valuing diverse perspectives and backgrounds. Visit www.velaw.com to learn more about V&E's Summer Associate Program and hiring opportunities. Start your success story at Vinson & Elkins. Julian Hobson is a partner at Vinson & Elkins in Houston, Texas. Her practice focuses on corporate finance and securities. She's been recognized as a Minority Corporate Counsel Association Rainmaker and has been selected as a Texas Super Lawyer several years running. Jillian is not only a leader in her area of practice, she is also a champion of diversity and inclusion efforts at Vinson & Elkins and was the first woman of color elected to the management committee. We spoke with Jillian about her 20-year career with Vinson & Elkins and how she navigated growth during that time, her role on the management committee, and how to create your own doors in your career development. Jillian, welcome to the show.
I'm so pleased to be here. It's an honor to be visiting with folks from U of H Law School. I'm always happy to come back to the Law Center and to help out wherever I can. So thank you for the invitation.
Yes, we're so excited to talk to you today. So we're going to dive in and we're going to start right where we always start, which is at the beginning. Tell us, where were you born and where did you grow up?
Right. So I am from the Caribbean or Caribbean, depending on how you want to say that. I was born in St. Croix, which is one of the U.S. Virgin Islands. So I am U.S. by birth, although from the Caribbean. I went to high school there basically left when I was 18 to go to college and came stateside. So spent my entire life on a very small island in the Caribbean.
Yeah. When I read that in your bios online, I was so interested in that, in that transition, because you spent your whole life in the Virgin Islands and then came to college. And that was your first experience mainland U.S. Is that right?
Well, no, not exactly. You know, as many people, actually, I think, St. Croix and the U.S. Virgin Islands are really close to Puerto Rico. And similar to Puerto Rico, there are actually a lot of folks from the VI and Puerto Rico that live in the mainland. So I'd spent time stateside summers and the like with family. And so been to the States lots. Just not to live and not to deal with snow, which that was when I went to college. That was my first real experience with lots of snow.
Oh my gosh. Well, being from Texas my whole life, you know, driving in the snow for the first time is always a shock for us as well. So you went from the U.S. Virgin Islands to Harvard, is where you went to college. So what was that transition like? And what did you go to study?
Yeah. So, it's a bit of a rude awakening in some respects. Again, there was the weather to contend with. So weather in Cambridge is very different, actually, from weather in Texas, where we are right now, except with the exception of the recent ice storm. Mm-hmm. That was a little bit of a shock in the literalist sense. But, you know, the environment just generally, again, I went to school. The island I grew up on had less than 60,000 people. I went to school that had about 120 students total. And so going to Harvard, where we had 4,000 kids in undergrad, about 800 actually students in my entering class, was just very, very different from that perspective. So a lot larger. But then we also had students from all parts of the world who some of whom, frankly, just had amazing backgrounds, really just, you know. So it was an intellectual awakening in lots of respects. And it was also a bit of a cultural awakening. But it was good. I mean, you could find, the one thing about Harvard is, you know, you really have the opportunity to find people that you connect with and make new friends. And so it was good from that perspective, but there certainly was a lot of getting adjusted to it. So
yeah, absolutely. I can only imagine going from a small community to such a different communities and a larger community at that. And you got your bachelor's degree in government. So at that time, did you know that you had an interest in legal studies or in policy?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. No, my process to being a gov jock, as they refer to them in college, was a little bit circuitous, I suppose. So I actually thought I went to college to study engineering. And so, you know, the first fall on campus, I spent a fair amount of time with classes that were literally, it felt like foreign languages to me. And while that was interesting in some respects, I really don't know that I was quite as prepared as some of the kids who really, again, just had these amazing backgrounds to really do that work in that way, and just found it to be just very, very competitive and very stressful. But what was great is, you know, in some of my liberal arts classes that I took, I really found a love for the liberal arts and spent a fair amount of time thinking about what I wanted to do. And I sort of knew when I went to college that I wanted to be a lawyer. I had sort of evaluated the different professions. I decided that, you know, I was going to get an engineering degree because that seemed to make sense. And then I bounced off with a law degree, which in my mind made lots of sense, but I couldn't squeeze a doctor in there. So yeah. It was sort of like pick your profession. But for me, so since I really had gone in with the view that even if I did engineering, I would end up ultimately pursuing a legal career, going into government really was a natural progression once I decided that I didn't want to pursue an engineering degree. So that's how I got to the government program. Harvard does a phenomenal job with making that, you know, really offering you lots of different ways of looking at study of government, whether mm-hmm. it's more international focus or, you know, U.S. focus, or the sociology of it. I mean, there's lots of great classes. And so that ended up being a good decision for me. And actually I thought was helpful for law school.
Yeah, no, that would be really helpful to have some of that background before you get into law school, for sure. So it sounds like you didn't have initially like a hard plan that you were going to go straight to law school. At least you thought you would get your engineering degree and then kind of go from there. Did you have any lawyers in your family or any influences from your upbringing that kind of put you on that path?
No, my mom is a hairdresser, and my father at the time sold insurance. He now is involved in housing construction. So I did not have lawyers in my family. I really didn't have professionals. Now I feel like I'm dating myself because I'm the person that was like first generation. And so I guess I really was sort of first generation along with my cousins that are sort of similar age, but we were the first in our families to pursue graduate degrees and really in some respects get to college. So I did not have that influence, but again, I think I just sort of decided very early on what I wanted to do and sort of the path. And occasionally I've pivoted in that, but really knew I was going to be a professional in some degree. I wasn't going to be able to be a doctor because the sight of blood does not sit well with me. So that was getting ruled out. That got ruled out very early on. But it seemed to resonate. I mean, I love to read. I really embrace history and sociology and all things related to sort of the liberal arts. None of which necessarily get you to the law, but I also consider myself to be somewhat of an advocate for issues. And so it just seemed like being a lawyer would maximize the things that I like and the interests that I had and give me a platform to do lots of things in. So that, at least that's how I rationalized it at the time.
Yeah, no. And you're in good company. I'm also a first gen lawyer professional in my family as well. So not dating yourself there. I'm curious, you went to Harvard, came from St. Croix, and then you went to law school at UH. So that's awesome. We love to have our alums on the show. And you join the part-time program. So tell us a little bit about that process. Did you get a job straight out of college? And then did you work during the law school program?
Yes, yes. So, you know, first generation college student, and, you know, I mentioned that my family, we weren't necessarily from well-to-do means. So for me, it was important as I was thinking about grad school to think about a practical way to pay for it, particularly given that I had loans coming from Harvard. And so, you know, when I was looking at schools, I moved to Texas and I looked at UT and I looked at U of H. And I will tell you, I mean, the U of H, the program that they provide for students to work and go to school just really appealed to me. It felt like it was a good way to finance my my grad school education. It was a little challenging to do that. I actually, so I worked initially with a company that at the time was a subsidiary of Dow Chemical in their tax group.
Okay.
And so I would work full-time in the day and then go to classes at night. And the program at the time basically took you all pretty much year round. I mean, I think we had a good break at winter and then there was a break in the summer, but you pretty much went to school all year round. So I was working full-time and then also going to school at night. And so, you know, that was challenging, but I will say this for the program, it attracts, at least at the time I was there, it attracted a wealth of experience. I mean, we had a physics professor in the class. We had people with multiple degrees in the class. We had, you know, lots of working professionals who really, and the conversations were just so enriched because, I mean, I was actually one of the young ones in the class, I guess, because most of these folks were doing this, you know, second or third careers.
Yeah.
And so, but that just gave me just a completely different insight into our discussions on the law and application and practicality and the like. And so really actually enjoyed that program. I think U of H did a phenomenal job with that program. And I hope that people are still getting the benefit of it. Cause for me, at least, it was an interesting way. And over time I switched over to the full-time program and stopped working during the day. And that was, you know, it was helpful to do that too. I got to know a few more of the folks that I was in school with, the students that went there, you know, full time. It was good to interface with them. But that was a challenging way to go to law school, but I actually think it was very enriching as well.
Yeah, well, and I'll add here, Robert and I both started in the part-time program and switched to full-time. So we also benefited and can attest to the fact that there is still a wealth of experience in UH's part-time program. And we both think it's a fantastic program. So we're glad to have someone that has also had that experience even a few years back from us. When you were at UH, at what point did you start to get a sense of what kind of law you might want to practice or where you might want to narrow your focus once you became a practitioner?
That's a great question. I had the opportunity along the way to do a few clerkships with firms. And so just managed to work it out with my job and the like to facilitate that. And so that was helpful in sort of narrowing the scope. But I guess, you know, going into law school, I think if you spoke to people who knew me going into law school, they would have said, oh, she's going to be a litigator. Advocacy is something that I enjoy. But I actually, it was interesting. I think on reflecting more about my personality, reflecting more about the practice of law and what I really wanted to get out of it, I pretty quickly on, I think I clerked at a firm that had a bankruptcy shop or practice. I did something that had a little bit of family law to it and really early on decided that I just wanted to be a transactional lawyer. I wanted to work on deals. You know, I wanted to work in an environment where I felt like both sides were advocating for the same objective by, you know, wanting to complete a transaction. And so unlike in litigation, where oftentimes, you know, you've got someone who's going to win and someone who's going to lose,
right?
Or you settle and people feel like winners and losers and to varying degrees. And transactions, at least the practice that I have, you know, we are very much aligned in terms of getting a deal done. Now, you know, I'm advocating for my client and trying to get them the best terms for the deal and trying to mitigate risk associated with the transaction. But there's just a different collaborativeness amongst the deal team. And then you find, I think, in litigation. So that once I sort of had some experiences understanding the different practice areas and how transactions are, you know, are different from being in litigation and being in front of a court, which, you know, appeals to so many law students, I think, on, yeah, it's sort of this is what you see on law on TV.
Right.
And so that that really appeals to the essence of who you are. Like, you want to just be that advocate who's speaking in the courtroom and trips up a witness in the best way possible and has that moment. We don't quite have those moments in transactional practices. I mean, occasionally there are, but generally speaking, it's just different. And so for me, really reflecting on my personality, I thought that was the best way to go. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I had the opportunity to sort of try it. I always tell law students, you know, clerking, even if you have to do it for free, or figuring out how to get those opportunities where you get exposed to what the practice of law actually is, so beneficial if you can get it. And so completely encourage everyone to try to do that. And even frankly, clerking for judges, just really understanding how the legal system works in the different types of practice areas and seeing the different skills of lawyers will help you frame, you know, better for yourself where you fit in that mix. And so I was absolutely fortunate to have those opportunities.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's important to kind of point out from what you were saying, or what I was picking up from that is, you know, someone can see you and know you and think like, oh, you're going to be a litigator. Like, your personality, it just fits this. But until you get out there and try it, it's hard to know from what we experience in law school and what we see on TV, what it really means to be, say, a transactional lawyer or a litigator. I'm glad that you shared that and would also encourage students to get those experiences if they can. So after law school, you started out at Andrews Kurth, now Hunt and Andrews Kurth, as an associate. And you knew already at that point that you wanted to do transactional work. What type of work specifically were you doing when you started out? Was it a general practice, or did you start pretty quickly into a specific practice?
Yeah, so certainly at the larger firms, I think it's true that, you know, during a summer, you have the opportunity to rotate through different sections or different practice groups to get a better sense of the different types of practices. But most of the large firms, certainly at the time that I was clerking, you know, once you accept, then they put you in a particular practice area. And they generally are trying to sort of manage to something hopefully that aligns with your interests. So, so you know, you don't end up having to be a litigator when you thought you were going to be a tax lawyer. So they try really hard to get that right. So for me, I had accepted into the what was AK's corporate group at the time. And the corporate group did a mix of mergers and acquisition work, as well as securities related work. And so what that means is, on the M&A side, if you're an M&A lawyer working mergers and acquisitions, you are assisting companies either in buying and selling assets. So, you know, they've got, you know, a bunch of trucks that they want to sell, or they've got some facility that they want to sell, or some part of their operations that they want to sell or buy from someone else. And you help them in papering that transaction. On the security side, examples would include things like, there's a company that, let's say they sell RVs, and they decide that they're going to go buy a bunch of RV companies, and then they want to go public. So they basically want to consolidate a bunch of businesses, and then they want to be able to allow investors to invest in their company. So, you know, today you can go buy a share of Google or Amazon or pick your public company stock. I basically help those public companies in selling their securities to the public. Or going public if they're not currently public. And so, you know, what appealed to me in part at the time is, you know, I'd work on lots of deals, and they would be, whether it's in the Houston Chronicle or Wall Street Journal for some transactions, I always felt good because we'd get a deal done and then I'd say, oh, look, I'm in the paper. This is great. and not that I was in the paper, but my client was in the paper. And so those types of deals. So deal lawyer, working on papering transactions, both in terms of helping companies raise capital, and, you know, when we say raise capital, they're just basically getting investors to invest and then taking that money that investors give them to reinvest in the company, whether it's expanding products or expanding the facilities and like, and then also helping them either buy or sell assets or sometimes merge. So I worked on, it's been years ago now, and this is post AK, but I worked on the Continental United merger.
Oh, wow.
Which people will, if you're from Houston and you're as old as I am, at least, you might not think that was the best deal ever, but only because it was when we had Continental with their hub here, I think we had just a little bit more in terms of privileges for flying, but it was certainly a transaction that reshaped the face of the airline industry. So I had the opportunity to work on that, and that was a pretty cool deal as well.
Yeah, and I feel like I want to thank you, because I feel like we just got the best corporate transactions 101 summarized in about 2 minutes. And I'll share with you that my 1L summer as a clerk, my first day I was Googling what is capital markets. And I feel like if you had just explained that to me on day one, I would have been ahead of the game. So thank you for that. That will be so helpful to students. And so cool that you were on that Continental deal, because it really did. It changed the face of airlines as we know it. And it's cool to have been in that process. So after Andrews Kurth, you went to V&E, Vinson & Elkins, where you currently are a partner now, and you have been there for the past 21 years, which not to date you, but I think it is just a really amazing thing to have had such a great career at one firm, and not something that we see as much today. We see a lot more young associates lateraling and jumping around a bunch. And I think it's great that we get to hear from your experience staying with one firm for your career. So can you talk to us a little bit about, and you know, that's several years to cover shortly, but how you navigated that over the years? At what stages were you thinking about having career talks or movement in your career as you built this career at V&E?
Yeah, that's a great way to phrase the question. Yes, time has flown by. And when you said 21 years, I was like, oh my goodness, has it really been that long? Oh yes, actually it has been. So you know, I think, you know, there are certainly opportunities at every stage of your career to reevaluate what you're doing and to reevaluate whether that's the thing that brings you joy and really fulfills you. And I had some of those opportunities. I guess what I would say in terms of the decision to stay at V&E, again, I really like what I do. So hopefully, I'm glad that I explained it. Hopefully, you know, there'll be some folks that will listen to this and just think, wow, she sounds like she really likes what she does. And that sounds like a cool thing to do. So maybe they'll want to do it. I enjoy my practice. So first and foremost, you know, enjoying the practice. And we talked a little bit about really understanding who you are and the things that will resonate with you and fulfill you over time and trying to match those things. So I was fortunate that I got a practice that I think matches me from a personality perspective, mm-hmm. which is helpful. So I didn't really face that, oh, I don't want to do this anymore dilemma that I think some do. We see some young lawyers who come in and they think they're going to be, you know, this type of lawyer, that type of lawyer. And then they just realize I just not that interested in this. Mm-hmm. And that's fine too. But for me, so I didn't have the desire to change practices. And in fact, the opportunity to go to V&E from Andrews Kurth at the time was a larger platform. It really allowed us, I think, to grow our practice in a way that, you know, is one of the reasons I'm still a lawyer today. We just had the opportunity to work on really great deals over the course of my career. So lots of fun stuff that you see in the Wall Street Journal and like. So it's just kind of exciting to talk about it. But in terms of, you know, navigating your career, it's really important to find people who are invested in you early on mm-hmm. and give you good opportunities, right? So it's one thing to like what you do. It's another thing to have people who help you develop as a lawyer. I think, you know, some people have easier opportunities with that or not. I mean, you may find yourself at a firm where, you know, your family, depending on who you are, that your family members have connections. And so there's some easier opportunities for finding sponsors or mentors and like. I didn't have any of that. I was coming into it without really knowing anything about what I was trying to do other than I thought I would like it. And, you know, you have to spend some time developing relationships with people who then will teach you how to do what you're doing and do it well. And mm-hmm. I got lucky that I had folks who invested in my career and developing me and gave me good opportunities. And so I felt along the way as though I was progressing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important too. So one, you want to like what you do. Two, you want to have people who invest in you to help you progress along the way. And you know, you want to, even today, like you constantly want to feel like, wow, I am really developing in my career. I'm learning new things. I'm doing new things or interesting things, different things. Mm-hmm. That for me makes it interesting. And so, you know, have I thought about over the years about, oh, you know, maybe I should think about this or that or do something else? I have, but I'll tell you, I mean, you know, the grass is not necessarily going to be greener somewhere else. Mm-hmm. For me, it's always going to be about, okay, I like the people I work with. Because we're a fun bunch, even though we don't see each other as much during COVID, but it's still a fun bunch of folks. I've gotten good support in my career. I've gotten good work opportunities. And so it's going to be a high burden to make me decide I need to do something else, right? Mm-hmm. That's going to be a high bar to pass. So hopefully I sort of answered your question, but let me know if you have follow-ups or things
no,
that I can add on.
I think you summarized that great and gave us a couple of 1-2 steps that I think is always fun to kind of be able to jot down those specifically. I'm curious a little more detail on finding those mentors. Was that something that, you know, you mentioned that you were lucky to have people that invested in your career. Was that something that you were active in seeking those people out? Were you taking active steps toward that? Or did you have people that were more saying, hey, let me come alongside you and help you? Or was it a little bit of both?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, in the ideal world, you just find someone who just looks at you and thinks that you're just the best thing ever. And they'll just, you know, say, okay, you're going to be my person, and that works out. Mm-hmm. When you work at a larger firm, you know, finding just with the numbers, it can be a little bit more challenging to, you know, find the right relationships. And then again, I did not share some of the things that others do in terms of background experience and the like. I mean, I went to Harvard, so there's some people that went to Harvard, so that was helpful. I went to U of H, so there's some folks that went to U of H, so we connect over that. But I didn't have the, you know, other connections that lots of folks had. So I would not say that, you know, I necessarily, you know, on day one found the person who was like, oh, I'm just going to, you know, I'm just going to adopt you as my person.
Mm-hmm.
I had the opportunity to work on teams and deals with lots of folks. And over time, you know, I made it a point to get to know partners. You know, I was very thoughtful and methodical, I think, in trying to do that. And at points when I was frustrated, you know, I'm also not bashful. And so when I was frustrated about whether I thought I was getting sufficient support, I just would be pretty vocal about that. And as a result, I think it was in my fourth year, I ended up getting connected with the person who's now the chairman of our firm, Mark Kelly.
Oh, wow.
He was then head of my section.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'd expressed a concern around having the right support. And he was like, okay, we're going to work together. And so there, that began my very long, actually Mark and I still work together on D&I and other efforts today. And we're both a management committee. He's the chairman of the firm, but that really began sort of the, that relationship, which it was just, has been so helpful for me. So, you know, certainly you ask for what you want. In my view, you always sort of claim the things you want, but I do think you have to do that with some work. I mean, I think Mark knew that I was committed to working really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I spent a lot of time just trying to be thoughtful about, you know, supporting him and the things that he was doing. And, he in turn, again, sort of adopted me, which was great. And so it was a little bit of, you know, like you said, a little bit of both. Sometimes it starts off where you have people are interested in you. Sometimes you have to do a little bit of work. And I think folks should know that. I mean, I think the best relationships can be the ones where you are thoughtful about
mm-hmm.
What's the basis on which you're connecting with this person. You know, I mean, it's one thing to say, think that they're going to help you, but it's also how can you help them, right?
Yeah.
And so the sponsorship and mentorship, in my view, really work best when it's a little bit of a two-way street.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to be thoughtful about that.
Yeah. Well, and I love that you point that out, because for me, you know, going into corporate transactional work, you are on teams, but it can sometimes be intimidating as a young associate, especially, you know, I'm always thinking like these partners are so busy, their time is so expensive, like I'm worried about asking for things. So I love that you said, you know, you were putting in the work and doing your part, but at the same time, you asked for what you needed. And I think in a world where everybody around you is so busy, you need to be willing to step out and ask for those things, because nobody's waiting around to see if they're just going to come up on their own. So I love that you said that. I want to highlight that. And I want to shift a little bit, because you mentioned the management committee and the D&I team. And I think that's so interesting. I'd love to talk a little bit more about that. You were the first woman of color on the management committee at V&E. Can you tell us first just what the management committee means, what they do?
Sure. Yeah. That's a great question as well. Firm governance, you know, and every firm's going to be a little bit different, but the way I would think about it, if I'm an associate, is, you know, most firms will have either one or two leaders at the top, right? So there's someone who's either the chairman or the managing partner, and that person or people, if they're more than one of them, you know, they run the firm and they're, you know, spokespersons for the firm. They deal with the firm internal issues and the like. For most law firms, in addition to having sort of the top leadership, they also have the equivalent of what might be a board of directors, if you're a public company. And I think a lot in public company jargon, but you know, it's similar. You all, I think, for the law review, you have a advisory board, so you'll have people whose jobs it is to provide oversight on, you know, significant decisions that the organization will make. And so for us, our management committee is comprised of individuals who are elected by the partnership. So so that's, you know, in terms of, you know, I'm the first, I guess, woman of color to have been elected by my partners on the management committee, which is a great honor. I was like, wait, what is that? The happy Kool-Aid that they were all drinking. I'd love to get some of that. So, I mean, it's a great honor. And so just so thrilled by the confidence that my partners shared in me and put me for this position. So we get elected and then we provide oversight. So Mark and Scott, our current chairman of the firm and managing partner, you know, sort of run the day-to-day in various ways. Mark is primarily external focus, so dealing with client issues and the external face of the firm. Scott, in his role, deals internally with all of the sort of the business of law, managing the law firm and the economics and making sure that everything runs on time and on schedule. And then the management committee, we meet on a pretty regular basis, sometimes as often as once a week, sometimes a little bit spread out, but to discuss issues where we either need to vote, whether it's a new partner or a lateral partner, or it's on certain strategic investments that the firm will make. And we provide input on that. So we basically provide oversight. Because we are elected by the partnership, I think we're viewed as being representative of the partnership. And to the extent that we want to develop consensus, you know, we can be helpful in getting things coalesced by our partners. And so, it's been a real honor to serve on the management committee. It's one of those things that you get the call and people are like, congratulations and condolences. Because you get to be the voice of partners who have their frustrations with various things the firm are doing. But you also, you know, hopefully can be an advocate for them as well. And so it really is an honor and a blessing to get that opportunity to serve.
Yeah, and sounds like a really unique opportunity to have a hand in shaping the future of the firm, too, and what direction V&E is going. And you have a large hand in that as well, being on the Diversity and Inclusion Committee and being involved in that as well. I'm curious, kind of shifting to the D&I committee, which is a separate committee, I'm assuming, underneath the management committee, with other attorneys and partners on it. You know, we've heard a lot over the last several years and for a long time have been needing to see change in big law and hiring and retention of diverse attorneys. What actions do you see being necessary to get to that real change in retaining and hiring diverse attorneys?
That's a great question. Yes. So, you know, it's funny, when I was a young lawyer and I heard, whether it's female lawyers more senior at the time, female partners that were senior at the time or partners of color senior at the time. And they talked about the, you know, not having seen a lot of change. And I came in, I was young and I was like, it's gonna be great. We're going to change things. It's gonna be awesome. And the reality is for big law that, you know, change has been slow to develop in terms of materially increasing the number of diverse lawyers in the partner ranks. Now, I think we are seeing trends increase in terms of the percentages of both lawyers of color and women in the entering classes, but you hit the nail on the head. I mean, the issue is, okay, well, it's great if you can get them out of law school, but how do you keep them and how do you then promote them? And so we've been really focused on that issue. It's something that's a passion of mine. And, you know, when we talked a little bit about mentorship and sponsorship as being important to my career, I think that those tenets still hold true today. I mean, it is so critically important to find someone, and it doesn't necessarily have to be someone in your firm. I mean, I've had mentors outside of the firm. I remember Judge Gilmore, meeting her when I was a young associate, and I was involved with BALSA. I was the president of BALSA. We were hosting an event that year, and I didn't really know her. I saw her at an event. I was like, it'd be so great to have something at your house. I think people would come. The alums would be great. And she was like, sure, you can come. And so she and I have stayed friends ever since. And so, and she's, you know, been someone I could ask questions of along mm-hmm. the way when I was thinking about law firms and trying to understand that the dynamics in the city of Houston. So, you know, Professor Chase, who was my contracts professor way back in the
still
day.
Still our contract professor to this yes. day. We like Professor yes. Chase around here.
Yes, he was early on, you know, also someone that I had questions of. So you can find people outside of the law firm, but for your development, obviously it's important internally as well. And so one of the things that we are focused on and have been more focused on is really trying to make sure that our diverse lawyers and our women, you know, to the extent that they want, really have that support and get mm-hmm. Assigned or allied with individuals who are going to really focus and be thoughtful about helping them in their career development. So that's important. The other thing that's important, sort of related, but it's really work allocation is something that I've been very focused on at our firm, and just wanting to make sure that we feel like, you know, we've got a sort of a culture of entrepreneurship at the firm, which we're very proud of. It goes back to our roots representing, you know, Wildcatters way back in the early 1900s. And so that's part of our culture, and people tend to be entrepreneurial, but we have to be mindful to balance that with making sure that we are not excluding or missing, people aren't falling through the cracks. And so mm-hmm. we spent a lot of time talking about work allocation, looking at those metrics. This year we have joined, really last year, I guess we joined the Mansfield certification process, which I don't know if you're familiar
I'm
with
not.
That, just high level. So there's an organization that Diversity Labs that had a sponsored a conference a few years ago, try to come up with ideas to on how to increase, promote diversity, and particularly among leadership ranks as well. But one of the ideas that came out of that was similar to the Rooney Rule, which is, you know, when you're looking at opportunities, you know, if you have a space available. And so the Rooney Rule came out of football. Mm-hmm. So if you had a position that was available, you know, you had to look half of your or a third of your slate needed to be people of color, or not so much gender in the football world, but somebody of color had to be on the slate. Now, you might not actually give them the opportunity, but they wanted to make sure that you were taking them into consideration.
Okay.
And so the Mansfield certification process is one that I think it's over 100 firms now that may be participating. It's a large number of firms that have signed up. And the goal is to make sure in important opportunities at the firm that you are taking into account gender and diversity in providing those opportunities. And okay. so for us, we're tracking through our laterals that we hire, our new coming lawyers that we hire, people that we put into positions of leadership. When we publish externally, the composition mm-hmm. of those teams, we really are trying to hold ourselves accountable by making sure that we are representative of a larger group of diverse lawyers at the firm. And so at the end of the year, you basically have to certify whether for each of the factors that they take into account. So, for example, on lateral hiring, you will either have considered a third of the candidates, and they have to have been women or people of color. So, okay. If you looked at 10 people, then at least three needed mm-hmm. to be a woman or a person of color. And so, it's accountability. Once you are able to certify to that, then you get the Mansfield certification. And what we're seeing more and more is we actually are having clients ask whether or not we're participating in that program. And we're actually, I think we've gotten a couple of law schools that have actually asked oh, wow. us if we're participating. So
that's awesome.
So I think, you know, the entire profession's focused on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I guess the moral of that very long story is just to say that, you know, part of it is having accountability.
Right.
You know, if all we ever say is, well, you know, we can't find people, or we're not doing this or whatever, you never really measure your results, then it's hard to really challenge yourself. And so this way we're tracking, measuring, sharing mm-hmm. with our colleagues, and showing that there's accountability in the system.
Yeah. Well, thank you for giving us kind of that inside look, because as law students, we don't often know, you know, what's happening behind those closed doors or understand how law firms are making these decisions. So it's helpful to have that inside look. And And I would add to what you were saying that it sounds like whereas law firms maybe used to be more focused on hiring diverse attorneys, now law firms are trying to be more intentional about how they grow those attorneys once they have them. And it sounds like V&E is really making a strong effort in that. Kind of a similar question in a similar sphere. A mentor of mine has said that women, specifically in the corporate world, this probably applies to diverse attorneys as well, often have to have the courage to open doors and sometimes even create their own doors. And I'm curious, from your experience, have you found this to be true?
Yes, I think it is true that, you know, the path that has been established by many may not be the path that works best for you. And that applies in lots of different ways. And so, for example, you know, I know when I made partner and I started thinking, I mean, I thought about business development before making partner, obviously, and, you know, for a younger lawyer or a lawyer that's not a partner, most of the time that entails like doing good work for the clients you're serving, mm-hmm. With the view that you're going to eventually have to generate your own work, right? But you're not exactly, you know, you may not know exactly how that's going to happen.
Yeah.
You may think it has something to do with golf, but you're not really sure exactly how it happens. And so for me, you know, I like golf, but I just didn't want to spend the time to be good, and I wasn't going to do it and be bad because mm-hmm. that just wasn't going to work for me. I didn't view that as the path, for example, in terms of business generation or developing client relationships that I would, you know, it was not the door I was going to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And not that everybody does. I mean, I've got colleagues who don't golf, so that's not the only path. But I think as a woman in particular, you know, in a field where there are lots of men, you know, thinking about how do you develop relationships?
Mm-hmm.
How do you, you know, what's a comfortable way to do that? I mean, there's just the simple things of you go out to dinner or lunch or meals with different people. But, you know, and just in terms of connecting. And so I like the outdoors a lot. I was lucky early on to find clients who sort of like the outdoors as well, and actually have become great running partners with a number of my clients who like to run. And so
okay.
I have one former client who now lives in Arizona. And whenever I'm in the area, I go hiking with his wife because
wow.
he's not a hiker. But he and I, when we worked on the IPO together, we were in downtown Chicago, and he, you know, he we were determined to get our steps in because we were very,
yeah.
you know, I was focused on it. And he was asking me about my Fitbit, and I was telling him all of this stuff about why it was so awesome.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, well, I'm going to get one, and then we're going to get our steps together. And so, you know, finding ways in which you can connect with people, which may not necessarily revolve around golf or,
mm-hmm.
you know, pick your thing. Obviously, if you have kids, that can be something that resonates. Fitness for me, I've run half marathons with a number of clients now because I was like, oh, you want to run a half marathon? I'm happy to do that with you. So, so the doors, when I, you know, when you talk about doors, and again, I think this applies in so many different contexts. I'm just mm-hmm. touching on one. I think it's important to recognize that, you know, you can chart a path that's not necessarily the same as the path everybody else has charted it.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain principles that I think still hold true, right? So you need a door, you need to
yes.
open it. And so for me, that would be like in terms of clients, you need to have clients, you need to develop relationships,
mm-hmm.
but how you do that doesn't necessarily have to be the way that, you know, Mark Kelly did. Mark Kelly's a great golfer. And and sometimes when I have clients that I can't play golf with them, like, Mark, hey, I need you to take this client out and play yeah. golf with them.
yeah.
But leveraging, you know, figuring out again, those, you know, the right door for you,
mm-hmm.
what resonates with you, and still allows you to ultimately achieve the end. So that would be an example, I guess, of the way
yeah.
I would interpret what your mentor said. I'm sure there are lots of others. I'm not sure if that's what she had in mind, but that
no,
would be
I actually really love the direction that you took that question, because you're right. It can have a lot of different contexts to it. And I think that is a really important one that maybe younger attorneys, and especially law students, aren't thinking about as much at this point as far as business development goes. But it's encouraging to know, because I, as a growing up in a blue collar family, definitely have never golfed a day in my life, and am encouraged by the fact that I don't need to go get some lessons now. To have business development one day. So
you may want to. I mean, there are people that love it. So I'm not knocking it at
yeah,
all.
Yeah, maybe
saying,
I'll like it.
Yeah, you may like it, but yeah, even, you know, there's going to be other things. Mm-hmm. Just a lot, again, for younger lawyers, just to maybe hit the point. If you're a young lawyer and you're thinking, well, I'm not worried about business development, so what does this mean for me today as a young lawyer? I think, I mean, really, your clients effectively when you're a young lawyer are the more senior lawyers you work with, whether mm-hmm. it's a partner or a senior associate and the like. And in my view, the most important thing, again, as you're developing, is to have those relationships with lawyers who mm-hmm. will invest time in you. And then, and that just means figuring out how to relate. And so it's similar. I mean, you know, if you're a young woman who's working in a predominantly male team and the guys somehow are going off and drinks, and like, I mean, figure out how you connect with them or you mm-hmm. can relate with them in a way that resonates with you. And it doesn't mean you necessarily have to go have drinks with them. Although if that works for you, that's great. I have gone hunting, golfing, fishing. I mean, I've done all of this stuff because I'm really about like trying everything at least once. And so I've had all those experiences just to see if there's anything that would stick. But at the end of the day, you know, I've decided for myself, you know, what was the path that would actually work for me. Mm-hmm. And I think it's helpful when you connect with people across difference, when you're willing to put yourself out there and try something that you might not have tried, just so people know, oh, this person will do that. They'll step out of their comfort zone. And then, you know, then you have to figure out though, but you know, whether that's something you can actually commit to. And it isn't always. I'm not going to be a hunter or golfer or fisher.
But good to know that you're willing to try those things and at least get the experience, definitely. Well, Jillian, we are about out of time and we have just one more question that we ask of every guest, but I wanted to first say thank you. I'm so grateful for you sharing your time with us today, and I think we have so many great tidbits out of this conversation to share with our listeners. So thank you for that. And our last question for every guest is, are you pro Oxford comma or not?
What a great question. Yes. So I think of myself as being a grammar purist, I suppose. Mm. Which I'm not sure actually though what that means in this context, but no, I'm not a fan of the Oxford comma. Okay. I feel like that it's confusing. It doesn't resonate with me, which again, I don't know if that's the grammar purist response or not, but.
Yeah. Well, I'd be curious to take a poll one day between litigators and transactional attorneys and see where the line falls, because I feel like on the transactional side, I hear that answer more often, that why would we use something that we don't need and could potentially confuse a document?
Yes. Yes. It totally can change the shift, the tenor of a clause to mm-hmm. have it. Yeah. It feels completely inappropriate. So.
Well, thank you for that answer. And I'll let you know if I ever get those poll results back. But thank you again for being with us today, Jillian.
It's been my pleasure, really, and my honor. I'm surprised that you all reached out to me. I'm happy to share my thoughts. I have many, as you can tell. But yes, I wish everyone the best. And of course, if I can be helpful to folks at U of H, I am always happy to serve.
Thank you. Have a great rest of your week, Jillian.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening. Emphasis Added is a podcast by the Houston Law Review. Production is possible because of generous support from the Houston Law Review Alumni Association. If you have thoughts on today's episode or suggestions for a future episode, email us at emphasisadded@houstonlawreview.org. Follow the Houston Law Review on Twitter and Instagram at Houston L. Rev, or find us on Facebook under the name Houston Law Review.